Morning. Today's daf in Ksuvos is Yudches. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is one with Zeichon Ishmas, Liba Gabriel Bashmuel. We find ourselves on Yudzayin Amud Beis, right at the top of the Amud. And yesterday, perhaps one of the more interesting dapim that we've seen recently, in terms of Benhagim that occurred at the Chasnas. Some of them we can incorporate into our lives, and then some of them I could say pretty clearly we should not incorporate into our lives. Of those minhagim, why did the Gemara get onto the discussion of minhagim of weddings? As interesting as the Gemara was, what's the context? So it goes back to the beginning of the Masechta. I should say rather the beginning of the Perek. If you look back at Tezvav Amud Beis, where we started the second Perek, so there was a dispute, a disagreement between him and her as to whether or not this was her first time getting married or not her first time getting married. Such a basic dispute. And obviously there was no ksuva that would have clarified that. The ksuva for sure would have said whether or not she was a basil at the time, but there was no ksuva. And so now they are in litigation, and the basic dispute is whether or not this represents for her first time in marriage, and therefore the termination of this marriage should end off with her getting collecting 200 zuz. And his counter argument, which is, no, this wasn't your first time, this was your second, third, whatever, so, but you're only going to get 100. So the Mishnah says, if we have witnesses that can corroborate that she was a basula at the time of the wedding, so therefore she is entitled to her 200 zuz. And then it allowed the Mishnah the opportunity to give just a couple of examples of what are telltale signs at the wedding that she was a basula. And then that's how we got involved yesterday with the discussion of what are some of the other minhagim that occur at a wedding. If you go back to the Mishnah, so let's just go over what the Mishnah taught us in terms of what are telltale signs of the wedding that she was in fact a Besula. So the Mishnah says, Im yesh eidim, if there are witnesses, she yatsa behinuma, that she went out with a heinuma, verosha peru, and her hair was uncovered, ksuvah masayim. So the ksuvah is going to be 200. So the Mishnah gives two examples of what is a clear indication that she was a Besula at the time of the wedding. If you look continuing in the Mishnah, Rav Yochanan ben Broka omar av chila klayas raya, even the distribution of roasted grain is also going to be a proof as well. The Gemara over here, simple question. What does the Mishnah mean when it says that she's wearing a heinuma? So I left that untranslated when we went through the Mishnah, because A, I didn't know what it meant, and B, also I had a feeling Rashi said back in the Mishnah, wait till the Gemara. Gemara's going to explain what it is. So here the Gemara now is going to tell us what it is. My heinuma. We're on the top of Yudzayin Amud Beis. Surchav Bar Papa, Mishmei Daziri Amar. So Surchav Bar Papa says, it's just funny that how often do you see the names of the sons of Papa actually in the Gemara, right? At every one of the Siyumim. So we mentioned Papa, Rav Papa and his 10 sons. And I don't know how often we come across them actually in the Gemara themselves, but here's an example. So, Surcha Bar Papa, Mishmei Daziri Amar, Tanura Da'asa. So, it is literally an oven of Hadassim. So, exactly what that means. So, a picture over here would be worth 1,000 words. If I had a picture, I'd be in much better shape. He has a picture. Oh, he has a picture. Okay. That's nice. How do you find that? That's impressive. Okay, so Rashi,
somebody
asked. All right, Tanur Da'asa Rashi, chuppah shel hadas agula. Okay, it's a chuppah that is of a round hadasim that are around the head of the woman. Okay, even though the Gemara is usage of the word tanura, but tanura I guess is more have to do with the shape of it than the action. It's not an oven. So anyway, Rav Yochanan Amar kriyasa de minamna ba kalasa. Rav Yochanan says it's a veil in which the kala can take a little bit of a nap because it covers her eyes, and no one's going to notice that she's taking a nap. A kala on her wedding day, taking a little bit of a nap. It could be. In other words, it could be she didn't sleep the night before. She's tired. I'm not really sure, but Tanuma Rashi says, from the word Misnam name, we have that word come up a number of times throughout the Gemara. It means taking a little bit of a nap. Okay, either way, the point of the Gemara is very simple. There was a veil that was worn in the time of the Gemara where only the Basula, only those who are getting married for the very first time are going to be wearing it. Those who are not a Basula are not going to be wearing such a veil. Even to this day, there's a minhagim, even in the outside world. There are minhagim of what a first-time bride wears. In other words, okay, so the Gemara over here is just simply describing what was popular back then in terms of what a Basula would wear. And once again, that's enough evidence that would support her claim that she's entitled to 200 zuz. Rav Yochanan ben Broka, Amar v'chulei, Tana b'Yehuda Raya. Okay, Gemara quotes a brisa, and the brisa says, "Be'Yehuda Raya." Now, in other words, if you're living in the province of Yehuda, everything we just articulated in the Mishnah—I mean, everything—there are three examples in the Mishnah, but those examples that we gave in the Mishnah are good examples of telltale signs. But Bavel Mai, the Gemara's question is very simple. Okay, out here in Bavel, we don't follow these minhagim. And so therefore, what's the telltale sign that the woman at the time of the wedding was in fact the Basula? So Amarav Darduge Damashcha Aresha, the Rabbanan. So the Gemara gives a very interesting, and I guess we could follow this also under the category of old minhagim that probably that definitely do not happen nowadays, and you know, maybe we should not incorporate it into our weddings. So oil that's placed into the head of the chachamim. If you take a look at Rashi writes over here, "Deduge mishka nashim nostim shemen barosh hal talmidim v'safos." Okay, so without Rashi, I could have sidestepped it, but Rashi says pretty clearly that what the minhag was is that the women would apply oil into the hairs of the students and their beards and their mustaches. Okay, I don't really have a good explanation in terms of what's going on and why this is a minhag and what the women are doing with the putting the application on it. The whole thing seems to be strange. Go back to what we learned yesterday. There were other minhagim at weddings, which even the Gemara itself said, you know, don't try this at home. So, but okay, in other words, in Bavel there used to be some minhag that went along this line. So Rav Papa says to Abai, we're talking about the oil that you use for shampoo. Okay, apparently back then they had some sort of compound of oil that was used for shampooing. Yasma. So he says to him, now not the nicest way to describe somebody, to say the least, but Yasma Rashi over here means not, he does not call him an orphan. It means that you don't know minhagim, meaning that you don't have any type of tradition in terms of minhagim. Lo avdalachima darduge mashcha aresha derabanan b'shas maisa. So the Gemara says you don't remember where your mother applied oil into the heads of the chachamim and the time of the wedding. Meaning you don't remember this. Ki hada hu merabanan diasek lelebre. The Gemara gives an example of a particular member of the rabbinate who made a chasna for his son. Bei Rava Bar Ula, Va'amrila Rava Bar Ula, and a couple versions of who exactly he married his son off to, but either way, Yasek Lebrei, Bei Ahume Rabbanim V'Dar Dikmashcha Reisha. And again, the application of oil was put in the heads and the beards of the Chachamim, Bishas Maisa. Okay, at the time of the chasna. Okay, again, I'm not here to really provide a good explanation of what this minhag was and what it represented, and again, the point of the Gemara is that there were minhagim back then that gave very clear indication that the woman that's getting married is a basula. Okay, Amalas Amai. Now that we know the minhagim for the basula, were there any specific minhagim when a widow gets married? So Tani Rav Yosef, Amalas Aleisan Kisne. So the Gemara doesn't really give us what is the minhag, but the Gemara tells us what isn't the minhag. Aleis like Kisne, Rashi says Ein Lecha Klaus V'Zesi Mana. There were no roasted grains that were distributed at the wedding of an almana, and that was a minhag, that was a siman that the woman who got married is an almana. Okay, adkan. Okay, that takes us to the end of the discussion. It really should have gotten to this point yesterday. At the end of the discussion of various minhagim that were done at chasnas, minhagim that indicated whether she was a basula, whether she was a ba'ula, and we continue. Okay, we go back now into some of the more heavier lifting of the Gemara right now, as we go back to the Mishnah and have a discussion of the halachic significance of the second half of the Mishnah. Let's go back to the Mishnah and let's review. Our Mishnah is really a continuation of the first parak. The first parak was a number of claims, counterclaims. She made a claim, he made a counterclaim, he made a claim, she made a counterclaim. So various claims and counterclaims, and the question, of course, was, who do we believe, and who do we extend credibility to? And throughout the first parak, we had a machlokas between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua, where Rabbi Gamliel continuously said, we believe her, and we extend her the credibility, and Rabbi Yoshua says, no, we do not. They say that we do not follow what she says, but rather we go with what he says. And so we have a basic machlokas between the Tanayim, who do we extend credibility to? But as the Gemara itself pointed out, those are all cases of Bar Vishema, where her claim is a claim of certainty. His claim is where there is a lack of certainty. And so we have that machlokas. But if it's bari v'bari, but if the two claims are equally clear to each person who's making the claim, so then that's the first, that's our Mishnah here in the second perek, where the Mishnah says that we believe him unless he brings proof otherwise. And then the Mishnah went on to say, here Rabbi Yehoshua says, here's where I'm going to concede the point. Umode Rabbi Yehoshua. So I'm going back to the Mishnah, I'm just reviewing the Mishnah just to set us up now for the Gemara's next discussion. Umode Rabbi Yehoshua, b'amle chaver sadezeh shel avicha. Rabbi Yehoshua says, I will give you this. If a man goes over to another man and says to him as follows, let me tell you a little story. This land that I'm sitting on right now, that I currently own, this land used to belong to your father. You didn't know that? I'm telling you, it belonged to your father. Ulekachti amena, and I'm also going to tell you that I purchased land from your father. Shehu ne'eman, that person is believed. Meaning Rabbi Yehoshua is basically saying, I know that I've been discrediting every claim that we've seen previously in the Gemara, but this claim, however, I'm going to believe. And why? Because it's a substantial claim. What makes it substantial? The Mishnah goes on to explain, Shapesha asur hu apesha hiter. Because the mouth that incriminates is the same mouth that can vindicate. The im yesh edim shi, I'm sorry. And then the Mishnah goes on to say, v'im yesh edim shi shalaviv, v'homer lakachti amenon en neman. However, then, what would be the contrast? The contrasting case would be where, let's say the person doesn't incriminate himself. Let's say the person, witnesses step forward and said, hey, that person's occupying a land that doesn't belong to him. Or at least, I know for sure that it once belonged to that person's father, another person's father. So once a witness has now put him in the position of being in the hole, so now his own voice cannot be the one vindicating him. Because over here we don't have a peshasa hu a peshiter, that the mouth that incriminates is the mouth that's going to vindicate. Because others substantiate that the land belonged to another party, not to him. So that would be the contrasting case where he's not given that credibility. Good, so the Mishnah introduces us to the idea of ha peshasa hu a peshiter, and as Rabbi Yehoshua himself says, I'm going to, in that case, extend credibility.
What is the time frame? Like, if the person says,
very good. That's an excellent question. It's not, the Gemara is not going to discuss it. We'll get just a hint of that discussion in today's daf, in the course of today's daf. But that discussion is not had in the Gemara. It's an excellent question.
If you believe that, a year later, witnesses come.
Correct. It's a great question. I know the Rishonim discussed it, but after that, I don't have any good information to give. If you want, I'll look a little bit more into it. But that's an excellent question. Okay. Good. Yitzayin Amad Beis. But let's continue from where we just left off. The Gemara over here is bothered by the following. Look, I understand what the Mishnah is trying to do. The goal of the Mishnah is to construct a scenario in which that a person incriminates himself and then vindicates himself. Good. Why did the Mishnah give a somewhat more complicated case where this land belonged to your father and then I bought it from him? Why does the Mishnah give a much more direct scenario in which I say to the person, look, this land once belonged to you and I bought it from you? So the Gemara says, well, I'll tell you why the Mishnah doesn't do that. So the Gemara says, because the Mishnah also wanted to give a contrasting scenario. The Mishnah wanted to provide a prototype scenario of Hapesh Asru Hapesh Hitter, and then the Mishnah wanted to follow up with, and here's a contrast, where, because you didn't incriminate yourself, because others incriminated you, so therefore your testimony by itself doesn't stand to do anything. So the Gemara says, had the case of the Mishnah been, not the father, but you, he turned directly to the person and said, this land belonged to you, and I bought it from you. So had that been the case, so what would be the contrasting case? And over here the Gemara introduces us to, I mentioned it briefly when we did the Mishnah, but now the Gemara is going to be discussing it straight out, and that is the idea of Chazakah. So let's first of all acquaint ourselves with the basic idea, and then we'll see the Gemara inside. What is the idea of Chazakah? So it's occupation. Okay? I think in America they used to call it squatting, or squatter's rights. Well, occupation is basically as follows. If I'm sitting on a piece of property, how do I know that it's mine? So basically, the simplest way to show proof that the land belongs to me is some sort of title, some sort of document, a deed that shows that I'm the owner of this property. Okay, and when we to this very day, and every part of the world. So whenever you make a sale of a property, you swap a title, you swap a deed in order to show that you were in fact the owner of this property. Good. And so obviously the shtar, the document that is by far and away the easiest way and the best way to represent ownership. Fine. Do you have to hold on to that document for dear life for the rest of your life once you have a property? So the idea which is expressed in Baba Basra, which the Gemara here is discussing now, is no. You don't have to hold on for forever. 3 years. You don't have to hold the document for more than 3 years. After 3 years is come and gone, you're not expected to hold the document any longer. You being on that land for 3 years serves as enough evidence and proof that you now are in fact the owner of this property. Okay, and this is what's called in halacha chazaka. Now, there are two types of chazaka, so let's not get confused. One type we're going to be discussing, the other type we're not going to, but I'm just going to mention it briefly. And that is the idea of making a kinyan, making an act of propriety on a piece of land, can either be done with money, with a document, or with chazaka, a proprietary act. Okay, but that's just a mechanism in terms of how to buy a property. That's called chazaka from the standpoint of doing a proprietary act, like digging, like putting a fence around a property, but that's not what we're talking about right now. We're talking about shnei chazaka, the years of chazaka, which means that if you live on a property, if you occupy a property, 3 years uncontested. Now, that's the most important word in this discussion. If you live 3 years uncontested on a property, that property is now deemed yours, even if you have no documentation to show that the property belongs to you, because it's assumed that after 3 years, you're no longer expected to hold that deed and the title to that property any longer. Okay.
If you have any dispute during these 3 years?
It has to be uncontested.
During the 3 years?
During those 3 years. So the Gemara now says, fine. Now with all that in mind, let's go back to our Mishnah. Our Mishnah constructed a scenario in which Reuven says to Shimon, your father owned the property, I purchased the property from him. That's the case that we construct in the Mishnah. The Mishnah constructed. Well, the Gemara now wants to know, why not go through the case where Reuven turns to Shimon and says directly to him, this property once upon a time belonged to you and I purchased it from you. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you the problem. The problem is, let's take a very serious factor into consideration. And that is, I know he doesn't have title right now, he doesn't have documentation. If he did, we would not be having any discussion whatsoever. He's obviously without any title. But let's now think about the following. He's been sitting on this land. Has he been sitting on it for 3 years, or has he not been sitting on it for 3 years? If he's been sitting on it for 3 years, he doesn't need to make a claim. By virtue of the fact that he's been on this property uncontested for 3 years is all you need. There doesn't have to be a claim. There's no credibility that we need to extend. And if he hasn't been on this property for 3 years, so then what claim is going to help him? Meaning if he says to him, I bought the land from you 2 years ago, 1 year ago, well, now you need to show title. And your word by itself isn't going to mean anything. So what exactly is the case of the Mishnah where the Mishnah is describing that his claim becomes so significant, it's either he occupied for 3 years or he didn't. And by the way, there's a third option. And that is he did occupy but with a protest, which essentially means he didn't occupy the land 3 years uncontested. So the Gemara is bothered exactly by this question.
This becomes the second case, becomes a migu. The first one is If he has it only three years, it's not a migo.
In other words, the word migo is totally irrelevant. If he's been on the land for 3 years, he doesn't need a claim.
Exactly. But the second case is migo. Because he can stay quiet and not come forward.
Okay, but it's not... Right, but the word migo then becomes totally non-applicable. Migo means I'm making a claim and you're going to believe me because I could have made a better claim. Here, he doesn't need to make a claim. Over here, by virtue of the fact that he's been on the land, I mean, granted, he has to articulate, I've been on this land, and you need witnesses. The Gemara and Baba Basra goes through this in more detail. You need witnesses that you were on the land for 3 years, but once it's established you're on the land for 3 years and it's been uncontested, you don't need to make a claim. You don't need to say anything.
So why would that be? It's the case that he's 3 years has not passed and he's coming forward.
So then you need a claim.
That's not illegal?
No, you absolutely need... No, the 3 years of being on the land has to be substantiated. It's not. That's not going to be believed just basically because he says so. That 3 years that he's on the land has to be established by witnesses. So that's not a claim. So we're looking now for what will be. It's not going to be a unicorn. We're going to find it, but we're looking for that case where I need him to say something. What exactly is the case where there needs to be a claim? So the Gemara starts off like this. I'm starting again from the two dots. Listening, Moder Rav Yosef be Omer lachaver sadeze shochai salakachti amimcha mishum de kabay. Let me say for the Gemara. Says, look, we needed a second case in the Mishnah. Imi yeshedim shi shalom v'hu Omer lachachti amimenu einu neiman. If the contrasting case in the Mishnah is where where witnesses came forward and said that he owned the land, and I'm making a counterclaim, yeah, but I bought it from him, so he's not believed. So the Gemara says, "Hey Chidami." Well, the Gemara says, "Well, we need a little more context." Ida achla shnei chazaka. If he's been sitting on the land, the Gemara's terminology achla eating, meaning occupying, enjoying. If he's been sitting on the land for 3 years and it's gone uncontested on Maila Mehemen, so then he, of course, he's believed. But again, believed over here doesn't mean believed because he says so. It means that when you're on a land, squatting, occupying a land for 3 years, that land becomes yours. Not because you say so, but because that's the halacha of chazakah. And if he hasn't been on the land for 3 years, and the witnesses come and said, you know, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, that land belonged not to you, but to him. And you say, yeah, but I've been living here. Okay, that's wonderful. I'm glad. Maybe you owe him rent, but that land doesn't belong to you, meaning you don't have the halacha of chazaka, and just because you say you bought the land from him is certainly not going to be enough. Do you have a title? No. Do you have any documentation? No. The land doesn't belong to you. So the Gemara says, that's why the Mishnah couldn't construct this scenario, because quite frankly, this scenario, it's going to work or it's not going to work, but having nothing to do with him making a claim. That's why the Mishnah couldn't construct this scenario. So the Gemara says, Ihachi. Gemara says, okay, good. I get it. But now let's move on to our Mishnah. Let's go to now the case where our Mishnah does give us, which is Gabi Aviv Nami. The case of the Mishnah is this land belongs to your father. So once again, let's get some more context. Well, okay, the land belonged to your father. And how long has he been on this land for? Idach leshnei chazak amai lamehemen. Once again, if witnesses can testify that he's been on this land for 3 years, so then he's going to be believed. And again, believed over here meaning, not because he's making a claim, but believed because the land actually does belong to him, the halach of chazakah. V'idolo ach l'shnei chazakah. And if he has not been on the land for 3 years, pshita d'lo mehemen, he's certainly not going to be believed. Just because he says the land belongs to him is not going to be enough to say that the land actually belongs to him. You need proof, you need documentation. So Bishlam Agabe Avim Mishkachala. So the Gemara says, okay, in the case of the father, I actually do understand. There would be a construct, a scenario in which I need him to step forward. Kigon, Shach L'shtayim B'chaya Av, Achas B'chaya B'no. So the Gemara says, the case could go as follows. He's been on this land, let's say, for 3 years. And two of those 3 years was while the father was alive. And then, unfortunately, the father passed away, and he's been on the land now for another year. He's been on the land for another year, but at the time, though, the estate went down to the child, and he was just that. He was a child. So now, he was 3 years, and it was uncontested, but that last year can't really be called uncontested. Over there, the only one who would contest is a child, and he's a minor.
No administrative for a child to make a claim on his behalf.
Could be, but in other words, but that's exactly the point. In other words, we can't make an expectation of the child, nor is apotropos, if there is one, in fact, given to him, we can't make an expectation that, hey, you need to contest. Quite frankly, the child didn't know the affairs of his father. So the Gemara says, So Rav Huna says that you can't make a chazaka on the property of a minor, even after he grows up, meaning let's say years later, he's now an adult, and now the occupier has been on this land for many years. But because that third year of him occupying, which is the one that granted him ownership of the land, because of that third year can't be called the third uncontested year, so therefore he never made a formal kinyan, a formal acquisition on this piece of property. Okay, so that would be the case of the Mishnah, and that's why the Mishnah now is good. Meaning now I understand the purpose and the need of him making a claim. He's making a claim because his position is, I've been on this land. I've been on this land for many years. And now let me tell you a story. I purchased the land from your father, meaning you never knew that, and I'm also...
Why does the son have to be a minor for this? That could be an older guy who didn't know his father's affair.
It could be, but the assumption of the Gemara is that there he's responsible. And therefore he has to go through the process of contesting. That's the Gemara's assumption. Just give me a moment. So now the case of the Mishnah works out good. Because the case of the Mishnah is where I turn to the father and I say, I'm sorry, I turn to the child and I say, okay, let me now tell you a story. Story is, this land once owned to your father. You never knew that. And because he never knew that, now you incriminated yourself. Now you have the ability, the credibility is extended to you to get you out of it. That's the case of the Mishnah. Had it been he himself, and then the Gemara says, we would never have a case where I would need the claim, and the claim by itself would work. Claim would never work if he was talking to the original owner of the land. Either you were there for Shnei Chazaka and your claim is meaningless, or you weren't there for Shnei Chazaka and once again your claim is meaningless.
I thought you don't need a Kenyan by Yerusha.
But again, the Yerusha is being given from one to another on a land that right now is currently being occupied by somebody else. You don't need a kinyan by Yerusha. That's absolutely correct. But over here, the person who is reporting that the land belongs to him is not the one who is inheriting the land. It's the other party. He's claiming that the land belongs to him. He doesn't. It's exactly the point. If he had a star, we wouldn't need him. We wouldn't need him to say anything. That's exactly the point.
It's a case that if 2 years is not passed. 2 years passed.
Three years did pass. Yes, but one of those years is after the
2 years and 1 year of
right.
So why is that treated like he should just like case of 2 years? He should bring the title.
But again, he doesn't have it. Again, if he had a title, we would not be having a discussion. Mm-hmm. The case in question over here is he had no title, he had no documentation that the land belonged to him. And so now, it's one of two things that are going to get him the land. Either it's going to be witnesses that say that he occupied the land for 3 years, but the reason why we don't have that over here is because he only occupied the land two of the last years of the original owner's life, and then he died, and now there's another year that went by, but that other year doesn't count. Meaning 2 + 1 does not equal 3. Now that 2 + 1 doesn't equal 3, so now, if he comes forward and says, and nobody knows, and I know it's strange, and nobody knows that the land originally belonged to the father, and this is like lost on everybody, and he steps forward and he puts himself now in an incriminating position, in a compromised position, ha-pesha asu ha-pesha itir. Good. He's also now going to be believed to say that I bought it from your father, even though I have no documentation that this is in fact so. But that's exactly the point of ha-pesha asu ha-pesha itir. However, if witnesses step forward and witnesses said, hey, that land didn't belong to you, that land belonged to him, and now your counter-argument is, yeah, I know you're right, but, and he's going to give explanations. He can give all the explanations he wants. If you don't have documentation, if you don't have witnesses that say you occupied the land for 3 years, you have nothing.
But the is based on that concept that there's no contradicting evidence against the guy.
Exactly. So he's the one that created that position of incrimination. And therefore he's...
I'm saying you would never know.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely correct. Okay. Continuing in the Gemara, v'rav huna masitza nasalash mi'inan. So the Gemara says, okay, very good. So now, all this really, this entire construct scenario is based on a halacha said over by Rav Huna. But when all said and done, is what Rav Huna teaching us just something that we learned in the Mishnah? So he by saying Rav Huna diyuk de masitza kamar. So the Gemara says, no. First of all, none of this was actually stated in the Mishnah. Meaning it's a diyuk in the Mishnah. Good. So Rav Huna is teaching us the diyuk in the Mishnah that we need Rav Huna. And he by saying afil higdol kamashmalan. Or of course, there's another point which is Rav Huna is introduced into this whole discussion, and that is even after the child grows up, still because that third year was a year where he was a child, that doesn't count our shnei chazaka. And even after the child grows up, the occupier cannot say, hey, I've been on this land for a long time. It doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because 2 + 1 in this case does not equal 3. Continuing in the Gemara. So the Gemara says, okay, let's try again. What the Gemara is trying to do is figure out why the Mishnah chose the case of the land belonged to your father. Why not suggest the following? Let's say the land belonged to the to the person, to the principal owner, the original principal owner, and let the case be where 2 years was bifanav, meaning the occupier is saying to the original owner, two of those years I enjoyed, and you were right next door. And every day we came out, good morning, good morning. You never said anything. And that third year, what happened? The original owner had to go away. Now again, in order for you to employ the rule of chazaka, it has to be 3 years of uncontested occupation. So the Gemara says that third year, where the original owner ran away, why did he run away? Ukigon shabarach. Baruch machmas mai. The Gemara says it's important. Why do you run away? Ida baruch machmas nefashos pshita de la mehemen. So if he ran away because nefashos, meaning for whatever reason, whatever the case was, his life was in jeopardy and he needed to run away. So the Gemara says, okay, that is not an uncontested year. There's no way that could be called an uncontested year on the third year, right? The third year he's running for his life for whatever reason. So you you can't count that as one of the 3 years of you living in tranquility on that occupied property saying, well, the owner should have said something. No, the owner, that third year, that owner was busy, right? He had things going on. So, the Gemara says, and maybe he ran away for financial consideration. Okay, he was in a financial hole. Right, and creditors were knocking on his door constantly, and he just couldn't take it anymore, and so therefore he ran away. So the Gemara says, no, the Gemara says, in that case, he still has the responsibility, if he in fact was the rightful owner of that land, he still had the responsibility of contesting that he was the owner of the property. The Gemara says, we know that if you protest, even if you were not physically there next door, that still would be considered a valid protest. And now the Gemara quotes the Mishnah Baba Basra. There are three distinct lands. In other words, we do this all the time in the Gemara. We segment Eretz Yisrael into three different sections. Yehuda, Eivra Yarden, Vagalo. The south, the east side of the Jordan, and the north. And the Mishnah Baba Basra says that in order for occupation to be a valid occupation, you and the original owner have to be in the same province. And the Gemara says on that Mishnah, I don't get it. Why is it that you need to be in the same province? Is it because a protest... if a protest in a different area is not considered a valid protest, the Gemara says, so I don't understand. Even in Yehuda and Golo, if you say that a protest in a different land is considered a protest, so then what difference does it make if they're in different regions? And if you're not physically there, and if such a protest is not a valid protest, so even if you're in the same province, if you're not physically there, what difference does it make that you're in the same province? And the Gemara's conclusion about that Mishnah is that even if you're not physically present, you're in a different area, still, you have the right and obligation to protest if, in fact, the occupier didn't buy the land. If he's just an occupier. Umasnitzin, and how do you explain the Mishnah Baba Basra? B'shas Cheirim Shanu. That Mishnah over there is talking about where it was a time of Cheirim, emergency. It was just a bad historical time. People didn't travel from one place to another. Umayshna Yehuda Vagalo Denakin, and why the Mishnah give the example Yehuda Galo? This time Yehuda Vagalo Kishas Cheirim Dami. We're on the top of Yechesam Anaf. The Gemara says simply because Yehuda and Galo is always considered Shas Cheirim, kind of like the Mason-Dixon line, so to say, if you will, of Eretz Yisrael, where no one went from the north down to the south and from the south to the north, and so therefore, if somebody had to travel across border, right, to the north side of Eretz Yisrael, so then he is not expected to protest occupiers who are living in his land in the south, and that would be true vice versa. So the Gemara says, so that's why our Mishnah could not give such a scenario of the owner being in a different part, because quite frankly, then the occupier's occupation is not going to be valid. Velisne, we're now on the top of Yeches Amad Alf. The Gemara is going to have one more attempt. Velisne Modi Rav Yeshua Bar Melech Chaver Mani Levisim Imcha Uparasi Lacha Shu Neman. Okay, so Gemara, one more attempt in terms of what the Mishnah could have said. So again, we went through now, the Mishnah is talking about real estate. It's talking about property. The Mishnah is constructed with a scenario where the land belonged to your father, but I'm telling you, I bought it from him. And the contrasting case, of course, would be witnesses said that the land belonged to the father, and now the occupier is trying to get out of it by saying, yeah, but I bought it from him. And he doesn't have documentation, and he doesn't have 3 legitimate years of uncontested occupation on the land. That's the case of the Mishnah. So again, the first 2 questions that we fielded were, how come the Mishnah doesn't give a scenario of where he's not, his original claim is not that your father owned the land, but rather you own the land and I bought it from you. So the Gemara says because we can't construct that scenario because the factor of chazaka becomes then the most critical factor. Gemara now wants to know, why not have the Mishnah construct the following scenario? Nobody's father has to be included, and the scenario could be very simple. Money. Meaning instead of talking about property, instead of talking about real estate, let's talk about just simple money. And the case would be, the Gemara suggests, ba'omer lechaver mani levisi. Look, I lent you money. I'm sorry, I borrowed money from you. Uparasi lecha. And I paid it back. Why doesn't the Mishnah construct that scenario? And there we don't need anyone's father to get involved in this scenario. And it could be just very simple. We're talking about the 2 principal parties. Where Reuven says to Shimon, let me tell you something. You totally forgot. I owed you money. But I'm also going to remind you that I paid you back. Good. That would be a case of Hapesh Aser Hu Hapesh Yeter. Shehu Neman. And the Gemara says, okay, you're right over there, but let's go over what would be the contrasting scenario. Again, the Mishnah wants to give us a case of Hapesh Aser Hu Hapesh Yeter, and then the contrast of, well, you didn't incriminate yourself, but others incriminated you. So the Gemara says, what's the contrast? So the contrasting scenario would be, witnesses step forward and witnesses said, hey, Reuven borrowed money from Shimon. So the Gemara says, so the Gemara says, now remember, there is no documentation over here, there's no note, because had there been a note, then we wouldn't need everyone's claim. So the Gemara says, yeah, but the halacha is that even if witnesses tell you that you owe money, you have the ability to pay back the loan, and even not in the presence of witnesses. So you still could be in the position of saying, yeah, but I paid it back. So the Gemara says, fine, that's the halacha. So and again, that's all because there was no note, there was no documentation. Had the malva, had the lender had a note, obviously then his claim that I satisfy the obligation is not going to be good in the face of a note. Obviously, we're talking about a case where there was no note, there was no actual documentation. So finally, one last case for this discussion, which really is going to take us to the Mishnah on the top of the next Talmud. Why doesn't the Mishnah construct the following scenario? I borrowed money from your father. Once again, no, you didn't know about this. But I'm telling you, your father was a wonderful man, right? If you want, we could just add a little drama over here. He's paying a shiva call, and he says, "Let me tell you a little story about your father. Father was wonderful. He lent me $1,000. Just a great man. Oh, don't worry, I paid it back. Okay. And again, hapesh aser hu hapesh yeter. That's wonderful. So umod de Rav Yeshua b'omel chaver mani la'avicha biyadi ve'achaltiv pras shu neman. The Gemara says, but the Mishnah can construct the following scenario, where again, same basic setup, but here's how it went. I borrowed $1,000 from your father, and I owe half of it back, and I'm not ready to pay half of it back. Right. Shehu Neman. Under those circumstances, he would be believed. Okay, now let's go over with no documentation. Now let's go. Let's go over the basic halachas. There are not that many times in the Torah where the Torah obligates you and I to make a shvuah. In the halacha, there are many times when shvuos are required, but most of the time it's by the shvuos are mandated by the chachamim. The Torah only only obligates me to make a shvua on three occasions. Number one, partial admission. Right? Somebody says I owe money, and I say, I did borrow the money, but I paid you back half, and I owe you the other half. That's the case of modem and mitzvahs. I make a partial admission that I am on the hook for only part of what you're demanding from me. In that scenario, the Torah says you have to make a shvua. The other two scenarios in which the Torah obligates one to make a shvua is shvua shomrim, where somebody was asking me to entrust and to be a custodian over the item, and something happened to the item, and now I have to go back and tell the person I know I was responsible, but a mishap happened, something which I have no liability for. So that's another example where you have to make a shvua. Modeh b'mikdash, shvua shomrim, and the third is eid echad, where one witness has come forward and says that I owe the money, and it's not two witnesses, so then I have to make a shvua. That's it. That's all, the only three times in halacha where the Torah demands me to make a shvua. We're obviously right now focusing on the shvua of modeh b'mikdash, right, where I make a partial admission. Why not, says the Gemara, have the following scenario? I went over to a person, I said, your father gave me $1,000, I paid him back $500, now I owe you $500. Are you believed, yes or no? And if not, then obviously you're going to have to pay. You have to pay back the other half. That goes without saying. You have to pay back the other half. Plus, do you also have to make a shvua of modeh b'mitzvahs? So the Gemara says maybe that. Why didn't the Mishnah construct such a scenario? So the Gemara says, "Be'avechad to parashu neman, aliba deman." So the Gemara says, "Now hold on 1 second. Ialiba de Rabban Hamri Meshav Avei Dave. Ialiba de Rabbi Lazman Yaakov Hamar Shvua Baye." So the Gemara says, "Wait a second. In just a moment, we're going to learn a brisa together, and in the brisa, we're going to learn together that this is subject to a machlokas, whether or not you have to make a shvua, you don't have to make a shvua." So the Gemara says, before addressing why didn't the Mishnah give this scenario, the first thing we need to know is a little bit more information, and we have to know who we're going like. D'tanya. So let's go through the Braisa. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer Pamim Shadam Nishba Tanis Atzmo Ketzad. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, you know that sometimes you're going to forward information, and you're still going to have to make a shvua. For example, Mana Lavicha B'Yadi. Here we are. I borrowed a money from your father, Ve'achalti Pras, and I ate half of it, meaning I'm still on the hook for half of it. Hareze Nishma, V'zeh Nishma, Tanas Atzmo. So you now have to make a shvua because you are making a partial admission. Now, mind you, by the way, think about how strange this is. You're making a partial admission to whose claim? Your own. Meaning it's your own claim, and you still have to make a shvua on a partial admission, even though you're admitting to half of what you yourself claimed. That's strange. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov says, I know that's strange, but that's the halacha. You have to make a shvua of modeh b'mikdash. V'chacham memor meinenu einu ela kemeshav aveda upatar. And the chachamim say, no, that's meshav aveda. You're returning a lost item. You're returning a lost item. What's the halach whenever you return a lost item?
No swearing.
You don't swear. And the Gemara in Gittin tells us the reason why you don't swear is because the Chachamim want to incentivize people to return lost items. Imagine, I find a wallet. I return the wallet. The owner says, thank you so much, but do you know that I had $200 in the wallet and right now I'm only seeing $100? Any explanation? And now you're there, and the only thing you got going for yourself right now is I thought I was being a good guy. All I wanted to do was just return an item, and now I have to make a shvua. That's crazy. And so in the future, what's going to happen is you see a wallet. Okay, I didn't see the wallet. I'm moving right along. So the Chachamim recognized that, and the Chachamim incentivized. And the Chachamim said, you return a lost item, you don't have to make any shvuas. So the Chachamim say, same thing over here. If you're the one forwarding the information, hey, I borrowed $100 from your father, $1,000, and I paid him back half, and here I am now, ready to return the other $500, that's like Meshav Aveda. That's the opinion of the Chachamim. So the Gemara says, so we're trying to figure out why the Mishnah doesn't give that scenario. So the Gemara says, first things first, who are we going like? And the Gemara says, and let's even understand, meaning the Chachamim's argument is solid. The Chachamim say that if you're forwarding information, and now you're returning, quote unquote, the second half of the obligation, that nobody would have ever known had you not forwarded that information, that's like Hashavas Aveda. That's like returning a lost item. How could I know it's not the same, but it's.
But the thing is, with the loan, there's always the potential that somebody may emerge who's going to put.
Others have asked me similar questions recently about this as well. I hear you, but without a taina, without a claim, you don't.
But the thing is, it's an apples and apples, because with the lost object, you don't return it. Nothing, you know, like.
Okay, but if there's no claimant on the money that you owe, also nothing. So okay, I know it's not the same, but they're similar.
If
so.
You know, it could be just plain Jane. He owes him 10,000. He said, "Oh, I really owe you 500." I'm
good. Understood, but again, if we're talking about I hear you, but let's just deal with the Gemara at hand. So the Gemara says that. How do you understand Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov? Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, if you're the one forwarding the information, you're going to have to make a shvuah. That's crazy. It's like returning a lost item. So Amarabatar no katan. So the Gemara suggests, well, maybe over here we're talking about where the katan was the one who made the claim against you, meaning that there was a claim against you made by the minor son. The Gemara says the minor son made a claim. What's that? That's not a claim. A minor comes over to you and says, "Hey, you owed my father money." Okay, in other words, that has no halachic significance. So, my katan gadol, the my karle katan legabe mila daviv katan hu. So the Gemara says it was a son who was an older son. We'll call him a katan because, in regarding the financial affairs of his father, he didn't know anything. Ihachi tanis atzmo tanis achermi. So the Gemara says, okay, then I don't even understand the wording of the brisa. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov says that's a claim made on your own. No, it's not. A claim made by your father. There was a claim made against you. Okay, an adult son, but that's still a claim. So the Gemara says, okay, you're right. It started with a claim against you, and you admitted to part of the claim. The Gemara says, kulu ninu. Gemara says, you know, that's how it always works. That's mode b'miksas. Mode b'miksas is someone makes a claim against you, and you say, you're right, but you're only partially right. That's how it always works. So Elahachi b'derabba kamiflagi. So the Gemara says like this. The machlokus between Rav Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim is really revolving around a statement made by Rava. Da'ama Rava, mimnima amra Torah moda b'miksa satana yishava. Gemara over here says we're going to get into, and we're finishing up, I know it sounds funny, but we are finishing up, we're getting into the basic halacha of why does the Torah want me to make a shvua when I make a partial admission? Number one, step one. No one has enough chutzpah to deny the entire claim. Now I know you and I may empirically think otherwise, but that's far from the point. The Gemara assumes no one has got that kind of chutzpah. I owe money. There's no way. The starting point of any claim and counterclaim is there's no way I'm going to deny everything. That's just too much chutzpah. Why do people not have that chutzpah? So Rashi over here, Tosfos over here brings down Rashi. It's very interesting. Rashi says because if somebody lends you money. You're gonna now look the guy right in the face after he did such a wonderful thing for you, and you're gonna say, "No, I don't know." That's crazy. No one's gonna have that kind of chutzpah. Or Tosfos just simply says that it has nothing to do with the goodness of the lender. It just has to do with Baruch Hashem. We have enough of a conscience where no one's gonna make that kind of lie. Okay, uvekula by delo delay. So fine. So you're not gonna deny everything. No one has that kind of chutzpah. Step two. You really, of course, want to admit to the entire loan. And the reason why right now you're not admitting to the entire loan is because I don't got the money right now. So you know what? I'll buy time. So how do you buy time? I'll admit to whatever money I have. I'll admit to part of the loan. And so now that the Torah's got you in a bind, you're not going to deny everything because we don't have that much chutzpah. You can't admit to everything because right now you don't have everything and you just want to buy time. So the Torah says, I don't want him to be in that position of, on one hand, he's not going to deny everything. On the other hand, he's not ready to admit everything. But you know what? Torah says, we're going to motivate him to admit to the full amount by making a shvua. That's the genesis of the Shvur Moda B'Mitzas. Now, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Savaloshna Bavaloshna Bivno Eino Meiz Velkachlav Meshiv Aveda Havei. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says as follows. I think this is true both when you're looking at the principal lender in the eye, and even if you're looking at the son of the principal lender in the eye. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov says no one has that kind of chutzpah. Therefore, Rav Elazar ben Yaakov is of the opinion that it is always going to be a case of modah b'mitzas, even if you're looking at the son of the lender in the eye. And the Chachamim say no. We generally say that people don't have that kind of chutzpah when they're looking at the actual lender in the eye. No one's going to have that kind of chutzpah. But if I don't have to look the lender in the eye, and I'm only looking at the son of the lender in the eye, people do have that kind of chutzpah where they're ready to lie. And the fact now that he is either denying or, in this case, paying the amount, that falls under the category of Meshav Aveda. Again, going back now full circle, so the Gemara now says, why didn't our Mishnah give this case, this construct scenario? The answer is because this is a machlokes between Rav Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim, and it's predicated on how to understand the psychology, if you will, behind the halacha, behind modah b'mitzas. But that's why our Mishnah didn't give that scenario. And finally, the Gemara says, which is, we know what the conclusion was, therefore, the only scenario in which the Mishnah constructed is a case of property, of land, where we understand why ha-pesha asur hu ha-pesha iter. The Mishnah gave that particular scenario to illustrate a case in which you incriminate and you can get yourself out of the incrimination.